Now, as I've mentioned, this is our last live program for the year, and we'll be back live on air on Saturday, the 28th of January, for another, what I'm sure will be a very eventful year, as Hamish McDonald said to me yesterday on breakfast. But of course, there'll be a lot happening over summer as well, in the wake of the investigation into Russia's involvement in the US presidential election, and with Donald Trump's nomination of Rex Tillerson for Secretary of State, a man who in 2013 was awarded the Russian Medal of Friendship, and who, as the CEO of the oil giant Exxon, has huge financial interests at stake in the country, including the billions of dollars worth of oil contracts that would follow should sanctions be lifted. So there's some very interesting things at stake here. And I know that you can follow this. I have too on RN Breakfast and Drive have been following this in particular. It all adds up to substantial changes in foreign policy for the US and theoretically for us. What might be in store? Well, a skilled strategic observer, Alan DuPont, joins us now. I think he's well known to RN listeners. He runs a political and risk consultancy company, Cognoscenti Group, and he's a non-resident fellow at the Lowy Institute. Alan, welcome back.
Good morning, Geraldine. How are you?
Good, thank you. What do we wisely need to know about the situation, this really quite dramatic unfolding situation in the US around potential Russian involvement and influence?
Well, this is potentially one of the greatest geopolitical shifts that we've seen, probably since the Nixon administration, because if the US moves away from confrontation with Russia to some form of détente or rapprochement, it really could be a game changer globally, because it has all sorts of implications for the global balance of power and also for Australia. The problem is that we're of course not sure exactly what Donald Trump's going to do, but if you just look at his appointments, and particularly that of Rex Tillerson, it's pretty clear that he wants to put into practice one of his key promises during the election, that is to reset relations with Russia, and he sees Vladimir Putin as a person he can do business with.
Yes, I wonder how you assess, and this is all speculation, I accept that, the role of diplomacy versus the role of business. This has often been a tricky little quinella, or dance, shall we say, in world affairs. How would you see that unfolding?
Yeah, I think there's been a lot made of Trump's and Tillerson's, for that matter, business backgrounds, as if that somehow disqualifies them from being political leaders or even diplomats. I would point out that Tillerson, in particular, has essentially run ExxonMobil's foreign policy. I mean, it's a massive company. He sees himself as, you know, the company as an independent player. He's had a lot of experience dealing with political leaders right throughout the world, and particularly in Russia. So, you know, if you look at this another way, don't see him just merely as a businessman making money. To make money at that level and to deal with political leaders, you've got to have certain diplomatic and management skills. And I think Tillerson has probably got those.
Aren't they different, though, from essential diplomacy, where your purpose and goal is definitely not making money?
Yes, that's very true, Geraldine, and that's the challenge for both Trump and for the other business people on his team. It is true that the bottom line is what drives them in terms of their political interactions with leaders around the world. And when you're the head of state, or you're certainly the Secretary of State in Tillerson's case, you have to be thinking about the national interest in a much broader sense. Now, we don't know whether both of them are going to be able to make that transition. But if you look back historically, there have been other business people or people with non-diplomatic backgrounds who have actually made successes of the presidency in Trump's case, and the Secretary of State's position. George Shultz comes to mind, for example, back in the 1980s.
That was George H. Bush's appointment, wasn't it?
That's correct, yeah. So, and before that, too. So, you know, I don't think that that should disqualify them from the role, but clearly they're going to have to grow into it, and they're going to have to change their thinking, and I think both are capable of doing it. So I wouldn't discount them just on the basis that they're both business people and therefore won't have the political skills. I think they will have the political skills, and they'll learn about the constraints and limitations on their behaviour as they get into the job. As Barack Obama has pointed out, there's a bit of a reality check when you're sitting in the White House around the cabinet table, having to make big national decisions, much more subtle, nuanced decisions perhaps than you would in business. So that will be a test for them both.
What concerns do you have about Russia's supposed fear of influence? I noticed John McCain, the Republican, called it another form of warfare, what we're starting to find out.
Yeah, well, look, again, there are various views about Putin, and McCain is probably one of those who has the least favourable view of him. He calls him a thug and a murderer, and I can understand in some respects why he would do that. But on the other hand, there is another view of Putin, that he's an old-style Russian nationalist who believes in spheres of influence, wants to be treated with respect, so to speak, and believes that Russia was exploited during its 20 years of weakness after the fall of the end of the Cold War, and he's determined to make Russia strong again, very much paralleling Trump's agenda for the United States. So what he wants essentially is respect, and he wants acknowledgement that Russia is the equal of the United States and has its sphere of influence in Europe. But that's what he wants, and that if he's given that, then the argument goes that there is the basis for a real change in the relationship with the United States, and that could actually be a very stabilizing influence for the new emerging world order. Now, that remains to be seen, of course, but that's a plausible view.
So what if you were sitting in the CIA at the moment, Alan, with the prospect of, well, maybe having to deal more with your opposite numbers in Russia, if there is going to be this sort of greater liaison, let alone your confreres at the FBI and the National Security Agency, because we're finding out there's a great deal of enmity between all of those. And again, how do we in Australia, who supply them with intelligence via the installations at Pine Gap, how do we think about all this?
Well, The first thing I'd stress is the continuity issue, which is that while a lot of things may change, probably more things won't change. So if you were the head of the CIA, there would be a lot of things that you wouldn't be doing differently to your predecessor in the Obama administration. So 90% of what you're going to be doing is the same. However, the focus of the administration obviously will determine your intelligence priorities. So, for example, under Obama, the CIA was probably quite focused on Russia increasingly in the last 24 months because of the perception that Russia was trying to trash the old world order, and therefore the US needed to be something about it. If Trump succeeds in engineering a major shift and détente with Russia, then the focus will go off Russia probably onto China. So you're likely to see, and also Islamic State, because Trump has made it clear that he sees the administration's number one priority as to destroy ISIS, Islamic State, working in collaboration with Russia. So that would change your intelligence priorities quite a lot in that respect. The second point I'd make is that the cyber challenge to the United States security, and this is one that's important for Australia as well, is getting worse. And what may complicate Trump's and the future CIA director's attempts to engineer a change of policy and focus, to basically see Russia as more as a friend, is the fact that the intelligence agencies at the moment are now accusing Vladimir Putin of personally being involved in authorising hacking of the Democratic National Committee during the election period. In other words, political interference in the democratic affairs of the United States. And that's a time bomb waiting to go off after the new administration's sworn in.
Well, is it? Because, I mean, as people have pointed out, Josh Earnest, the spokesman for the White House, says they've been saying this all year and no one cared or seemed to really take it very seriously at all. So there's nothing new here. It's becoming more vivid. And what we're finding out is there may well have been a very personal sense against Hillary Clinton by Vladimir Putin, which does sound rather extraordinary. So, I mean, what's going to be different next year then?
Well, look, you're right in one sense that the US has known about this for some time and it's been front page news for a long time. But what's new, what seems to have emerged in the last week or so is the fact that U.S. intelligence community seems now to believe that the old KGB, the SRV in these days, and Russian military intelligence have been explicitly identified as having hacked the committee. So that's a bit more specific than a nebulous kind of the Russians are hacking in, right? And then if you link that with the latest information that's come out suggesting that Vladimir Putin may personally have authorized this, now that is yet to be sustained, of course, then that's what I mean by saying there it is a real time bomb waiting to go off, particularly if there is, the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence investigates this next year. That will give Trump's opponents in the U.S. Congress an opportunity to derail any rapprochement with Russia before it gets underway. So that's the big risk there.
So, yes, quite. And people like Mitch McConnell, I think, who's head of that committee, said the Russians are not our friends. I wonder where Australia... Should Australia just stay right out of this?
Well, Australia can't stay right out of this. We're engaged in all sorts of ways. I mean, not just because of our relationship with the United States, because we have similar interests in terms of the cyber domain, protecting our own business intellectual property, as well as our secrets from hackers. That include Russian hackers as well, because the Russians have been working here quite proactively over the last few years, not just against the United States. We also have to worry about interference in our democratic processes too. If you recall the Dastyari affair a few months ago, there are growing concerns about what China may be doing here in terms of influencing our political process. So the issues are quite comparable. And putting aside the alliance relationship itself, which is clearly going to change and morph over during the Trump period, many of the problems and concerns that we have, we share with the Americans. So all these things can't be seen in isolation and they're over there and don't affect Australia. They very much do affect Australia and in a global world.
And, of course, there are some critical elections, very critical elections coming up next year. France, Germany, Italy, the Netherlands. This could be a conspiracy theorist's Christmas party, couldn't it? I mean, you've got to try to weave your way through what's rational and what's not.
Yes, well, the big problem for Europe is, if you think about the old Western order, the two foundational pillars were Europe, of course, and the United States. Now, the US power has clearly declined relatively over the last 10 years, which has created opportunities for adversaries and competitors to challenge US predominance. And the same thing with Europe, that Europe is now on the verge of fracturing because of internal disagreements about political agendas, because of immigration, large-scale immigration, because of decades of poor economic growth. So that is a big concern for Australia, since we're a founding member of the old Western order. That's not good news for us, because the West, which defined not only the values of the old order, but also its institutions, is now collectively in decline. And Australia's going to have to be much more agile and creative about its diplomacy in this new world order that's emerging.
You know, everyone says this, final question, everyone says this, Alan, and we all nod wisely. How do we do this? How do we have this better conversation so that our leaders are well-equipped to position us properly?
Yeah, well, look, I without setting out a whole new foreign policy agenda for Australia in 2 minutes, I'll just offer a few thoughts. First of all, I think the debate that we're starting to have here about perhaps we've been too reliant on the US alliance is a good one to have, because I believe that we need to diversify a little bit away from the US. I believe that the US alliance is still very important for us, but we do need to have more friends and allies in this world, and that means greater emphasis on our Asian neighbourhood. And looking for new friends and partners, and including countries that may not necessarily share our values. Now, this is going to be something that's going to be quite confronting for a lot of people in our foreign policy establishment, but I believe that we're going to have to subjugate values sometimes to interests.
Like with whom?
And that's a bit of a return to an old-style realpolitik approach to the world, which we've collectively steered away from over the last 30 or 40 years in the relatively benign international environment that we all confronted. But I think in a tough world with lots of dictators running around, we might have to toughen up with our foreign policy.
You wouldn't like to nominate which country you're talking about?
Well, in terms of challenges to the system, I mean, it's pretty obvious that China and Russia are the two preeminent challenges. So we do have to think clearly about
I was thinking of somebody whose values offended us, that's all.
Yes, and in terms of partners, we've talked about engaging with Asia for decades, but we haven't, in my view, done it very effectively. But I would like to see a lot more emphasis on relations with Indonesia and with India as examples of two democracies in our part of the world that we've paid lip service to, but we haven't really done a lot with, in my own view. So there's some examples of the way in which I think we should be moving with our foreign policy and national security settings from next year.
All right. Well, look, that's exactly why we'll have you back next year on several occasions, no doubt. Alan Dupont, thank you very much indeed. Have a lovely Christmas.
Okay, it's a great pleasure, Geraldine. Same to you.
And Alan Dupont, who is runs a political and risk consultancy company called Cognoscenti Group. He's also at the Lowy Institute, and we will be following that, I promise you, all throughout 2017.